Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we are in-depth on how colleges are and are not handling student depression. These are exciting weeks for college freshmen, and perilous ones, too. The stress of adjusting to the course load, the pressure to make new friends and fit in. The fact that this is the first time many students have lived away from their parents. When Penn State examined the state of students' mental health, they found that rates of suicidal thoughts and self-harm had increased. One out of three students had seriously considered suicide. Today, a conversation about how colleges and universities are responding and what you should know about college-age depression. And as our guests join us, I think your experience would be important to informing the discussion today. So if you're under 40 and you've experienced depression in college, I'd like to know how your school responded. And I'm asking for that age group because I think colleges and universities are getting more aware of this. And so I think your experience may be different. So if you're 40 and under, you went through depression in college. How did the school respond? What actually helped for you? And if you have children who have been through this as a parent, what has helped them? How did you mobilize to address this? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, and I'm already seeing some tweets coming in on this, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Kaz Nelson is with us. She's Vice Chair for Education at the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatry. And Kaz, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Carrie.
Greg Eels joins us. He's Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Cornell, and he's with us from Ithaca, New York. And Greg, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Kaz, I know that freshman year can be daunting, and I mentioned some of these challenges, the course load, the being away from parents. What are some of the other factors that I haven't mentioned that happen to students when they get to school?
Well, just on the front of it, it's a completely new context. And so coping mechanisms that students may have developed in their home, resources that they reach for, things that they turn for, they don't necessarily have these things in a new place, in a new space. And it takes learning how to access all those coping mechanisms in a new area in order to be successful. And that's extremely stressful in a completely new context.
That makes sense. Greg, I was wondering if a number of these students who deal with this in college have already identified, you know, anxiety or depression issues, and so they come to school and maybe they're magnified, or is this the first time a student may encounter this and not quite know what to do about it?
Well, it's a mix of both. So you cited earlier in the segment the Penn State's data, and one of the things they found from people coming to counseling centers is over half the students coming to counseling centers have already had experience in the mental health system. So students are not coming to us as blank slates. They're coming to us with many of these issues, but as Kaz said, the new environment is an added stressor, which makes all of us less adaptive, makes it more of a challenge. So it's a mix. I mean, we also know from the data that more serious mental health issues like bipolar disorder, psychosis, sometimes eating disorders get worse in college. So many of these things become much more prevalent and also are seen for the first time. So it's a mix of people coming to us with treatment as well as people dealing with these things for the first time.
Yeah, Greg, that's the other question I had, given what you've just said about the number of psychological issues that may develop in college. I mean, is that in some ways because of, you know, age and maturing? I mean, are these the ages when some of this stuff will emerge for the first time?
Definitely. I mean, if you look at data on schizophrenia or various other disorders, you often see the manifestations occurring at this age. It's just the course of the presenting concern and the illness. But that being said, I think it's important to just acknowledge that these things are also contextual. When students go to college, they don't have some of the same supports that they had previously. They're in environments that are less structured. I mean, colleges and universities really expect students to do a lot on their own.
Right.
There's a lot of support that's provided. But it's a pretty big jump. I mean, I have a daughter who's a sophomore and a freshman and a son who's a freshman right now. And, you know, I've seen it for decades in my work, and I'm seeing it for the first time as a parent. And it's a hard adjustment. I mean, it's a very difficult kind of social change, and the expectations on you are much different than they were in high school.
Call here from Molly in St. Paul. Hey, Molly, it sounds like you've had some experience with this.
Yeah, I actually just graduated from a local university, and I found it really hard to get the help that I needed because, this, you know, you're feeling overwhelmed in college, then, you know, it's really hard to have to seek out those resources yourself.
Molly, was there no kind of information given out at the beginning of school or obvious places to turn when you thought, hey, I'm going to need some help and some counseling with this?
At the beginning of school, I don't remember there being, you know, any pamphlet or any announcements about where to find those resources. So having to kind of dig through my college's website and go through academic counseling to get to the psych services, it was kind of a hard road to take.
I'm really glad you called, Molly. And it sounds like you're doing better. Is that right?
Yes.
Good.
Yep.
Good. Thanks so much for the call. Kaz, how common is that students might identify a need to get some kind of counseling, but not really know where to turn in the bureaucracy of the university?
I think it's common, particularly when people are struggling and in crisis, to very thoughtfully know how to navigate websites and access resources, because you're using a different part of your brain in an emergency or an urgency than if you were sitting down to do research. And so the easier we can make access to these services where you don't have to use a lot of energy or brain power to get that information,
exactly,
that's critically important.
Yeah, Kaz, can I ask you about, and this is going to sound a little basic, but it might be important, for parents who may be taking their kids to school for the first time, what are the signs of depression and anxiety that might emerge, you know, as you're getting ready to go to school or those first few weeks there?
No, I think that's really a critically important question and can't be repeated too many times. Some of the things that parents are going to want to watch for is if their student or child is not enjoying activities they once enjoyed, if they have stopped attending some of the classes or social outings that they would usually do, if they're demonstrating extreme anger or sadness or grief around relationships or acting with apathy. And then certainly if there's any talk of death or suicide, that's extremely concerning and warrants immediate attention.
You know, Greg, I was thinking that the student going off to school for the first time, you know, a lot of planning, a lot of financial investment. I wonder if the son or daughter just doesn't want, you know, is putting up a pretty good front, doesn't want their parents to know that they're experiencing some of this apathy or even these more suicidal thoughts.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a dynamic we frequently see. And, you know, as Molly, when she called in, I mean, I think people also want to be very optimistic. They want to make this transition work because
right.
They've invested so much in it. And yet there are frequently difficulties. And, you know, Molly also referenced how it is hard at some universities to get the care that you need. You know, I've worked in college counseling centers for over 20 years at different universities. And matching the resources to the student demand is the main issue. The main complaint every counseling center has is there's more demand for the services you can provide. And yet it's also very important to reach out and meet them where they are, make the services more accessible. We have a program here called Let's Talk where students can drop in and see counselors at different spots on the university, which make it a little easier. But it's always balancing that the more you get out there, there's more demand. And I think for all the reasons you just talked about.
I'll come back to Let's Talk. That sounds interesting. But I think we have a caller who's experiencing what you've talked about, to Shannon in St. Paul. Hi, Shannon. A long wait for health services?
Yes. I just graduated in May, and my experience was that when I tried to seek out that help, I was put on a wait list for several months, which is not, you know, that's not quick enough if you are in crisis. And so I sought therapy off campus, which I was fortunate to be able to do, but not all of my classmates have the resources to do that.
Shannon, can I ask, and this, you said you just graduated from St. Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
So is this something that you dealt with through those 4 years of college, or did it just kind of emerge your senior year?
So I had been to the counseling and psychological services my first year at St. Thomas and didn't have any trouble getting access then. But then fall of my junior year, I was looking for those resources and had a much more difficult time.
So it's
my younger sister just graduated from high school and is starting college this fall. And my advice to her was to get a regular appointment on the books as soon as possible.
Oh, good.
So that if she does need that access, she already has that.
I mean, so in the midst,
and doesn't have to wait.
Right. I was going to say, in the midst of all this, then you have to try to find help outside of the school. And it's a good thing mm-hmm. that you're in a city where you can find that kind of help. Because what if you'd been in a school that's in a more rural area?
That's certainly true. And questions like transportation, you know, a lot of college students don't have a vehicle or, you know, things like that. It's all very new. And then on top of your schoolwork and extracurriculars.
Right. Yeah, I really appreciate you calling. Greg, what do you hear in that?
Well, I mean, I hear what is unfortunately too many students' experiences. And I think every counseling center is always balancing access and treatment. So, you know, the advice she gave to her sister is good advice. I mean, once you get into the system, you oftentimes do have treatment that then's provided, the clinic's taking care of you. But every clinic that I know of or counseling center I know of across the country is struggling with how do you do that well and provide access to every student. So that's another thing where if you do a private practice, you know, you're just seeing the people who walk in your door. And when you're full as a private practice, you're full. No counseling center can say that. We have a responsibility to every student on campus. And balancing those two things when many times resources are being reduced is a challenge.
So when you said a minute ago that you have this Let's Talk program mm-hmm. at Cornell, that is just a student is experiencing some concerning signs. They can just drop into the counseling center and have a conversation with a counselor right then?
Well, so we have licensed psychologists and social workers at 10 different locations, so it's not even in the counseling center. The idea is that we're outside of the boundaries because sometimes people, like you said, their stigma, they have reluctance of even coming in. So we are out at athletics, we're out at an Asian American Studies program, we're out at a residence hall, and people can drop in for a very informal consultation where you can determine whether do you need to just to problem solve for a little while or do you need therapy? Sometimes they get referred for therapy and medication if they really need treatment, if you're seeing the development of bipolar disorder or something more serious. So it really is a first step. But still, I mean, we still struggle with how much treatment we provide and how long can we see people and when do we refer them out?
Hearing from you on Twitter here, and I put a question out that said, have you experienced this in college and what helped? And I'm hearing from students who say taking less credits keeps my mental illness at bay, but unfortunately I cannot qualify for FAFSA unless taking more credits than I can manage. And then another listener here says quitting, at least for me, but it was the last option. People helped too. I'm an introvert, but talking with loving people did help a bit. You know, Kaz, it just occurred to me that maybe the college bureaucracy is not quite set up to respond to individual mental health crises for students, right? I mean, I'm hearing about losing the FAFSA opportunity here. You slip behind in school. How do schools respond to that? Do you know?
Well, obviously, things are so high stakes for college students. Many college students are looking at obtaining degrees even beyond their college years. And so there's so much pressure regarding financial aid, number of credits, and how do I get the right classes and the right grades in order to get to college. And so schools have to be both responsive to those needs and that structure and the ability to accredit people, and then also individualized learning pathways to support individual mental health needs. And it's very difficult to balance those two. Sometimes disability resource centers can come into play in managing that tension and providing accommodations for students. And so that's often a good option to seek out.
Wait a minute. Did you say disability resource centers?
Yes. So for people who maybe have a diagnosable mental illness or have learning disabilities that would allow them to have certain accommodations in terms of number of credits or, longer length of time to take an exam, a formal process within the school can help to facilitate those things.
Dale says on Twitter, just dropped off a freshman at DePaul. Part of both the student and parent orientation was a session about counseling and depression. If you've just tuned into the conversation, I want to let you know what we're talking about. We're devoting the full hour this morning to college depression, aware that a number of students are going off to school for the first time, that this is a time of anxiety and expectation for parents and students, and looking at some research that says that many, many students come in with or experience some kind of anxiety or depression in school. We're asking this morning about the research on that, what the experience is like at a college or university. How are they responding? Greg Eels is with us. He's director of counseling and psychological services at Cornell. And Kaz Nelson is vice chair for education at the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatry. And I want to hear from you. And you may be hearing me say, if you're under 40 and you've experienced depression in college, how did the school respond? And I'm asking for that because I think schools, as we're hearing from our guests and from you, are changing and responding more quickly, more aware of this. But if you've had children and they've been going through this too, what helped for them? If you get a busy signal on the phone lines, you can reach me on Twitter. It's at CarrieMPR, 651-227-6000. Well, we have an open line, or 800-242-2828, to Christine in Minneapolis. Hey, Christine, hi. Hi, Christine, are you there? Hi.
Hi, this is Christy.
Oh, hi. It's good to have your call. Tell me about your experience.
I'm so grateful you're talking about this. I've struggled with clinical depression my entire life, and I dealt with it all 4 years during my college experience at St. Olaf. And there just weren't the available resources that I needed with clinical depression. I was lucky enough to have a sister in the cities that took me to Abbott for an inpatient program. But that made it difficult. I had to leave school for a few weeks and hop back in. I did consider dropping out. I actually did take a semester leave of absence and had to make that up later in the summer. But, man, I agree. Taking less credits was one way I was able to cope during the next semester. Professors were very understanding and just very nurturing, but there lacked that resource that I really needed at the time, and I think that others lacked as well.
Yeah, I'm really glad for your call, Christine. It brings up a few more questions here for Greg. Greg, it sounds like Cornell, under your direction, is really leaning into this. Is it taking more time for a number of schools and universities to get with this, to confront what Christine is talking about?
Well, yeah, and it's not so much time, it's really resources, because, I mean, the question for every counseling center is, how much do you do? I mean, we have 38 mental health professionals at Cornell for 22,000 students. We do our best to provide outpatient care, but sometimes students need inpatient care or need a partial hospitalization program like the caller just talked about, which no college or university is going to be able to do. And I think the question is always, how much care do you provide? Who pays for it? Because it's ultimately going to be the students who pay for it through tuition or student health fees, and figuring out how much you do. And we try to balance that access and treatment as much as possible. But the thing we always find, and most counseling centers find, is it's never enough. And sometimes students do need to take some time off. And I think that's something we need to talk about, too, and why this conversation is so important is, you know, if you're depressed, take care of yourself first. Don't try to just gut it out and not get treatment, because you're not going to learn as much. You're not going to get as much out of it. I mean, we struggle with that here, of encouraging students to take health leaves, go away for 6 months, get the treatment you need, come back. Our goal is to help you succeed. We'll support you when you're back. But, you know, we're not an outpatient or an inpatient or partial hospitalization program. So kind of balancing that, having those conversations are a big part of the work. But I think what the caller just said is really exemplary. That's what you want to do to get through.
But, you know, Greg, no matter how understanding I think the school is, it's still the student that then has to deal with, I'm 6 months behind, this is a competitive place to be.
Sure.
You know, I've had to interrupt my education plans here. Tough choice.
One of the things I would say is just one of the unfortunate shifts in how I've seen higher education in our country is it's been shifted to this very competitive thing versus a process for learning and figuring out how you fit in our society and what you want for your life. If you take 6 months off, you're not behind. It's not a race. The goal is for you to have an experience where you're educated, where you're bringing meaning to your experience in your life, and you learn to take care of yourself. So, you know, Cornell had some high-profile suicides, and our president, David Scorton, at the time said, if you learn anything at Cornell, learn to take care of yourself.
Wow, that's
smart.
That's
an important life skill. You know, it's not a race. You're not behind. I mean, that kind of mentality I think students have to get out of. If you're really experiencing those things, do what you need to do. Take care of yourself. Your educational experience will be much better if you do.
You know, Kaz, easier said than done, though. I hear what Greg is saying, but, you know, for your whole preparation to get into school, it is kind of a competition. And I know it's not a race specifically, but boy, we know how students feel the pressure to get into a good school and then to do well once they're in school.
Yes, and to make matters worse, there is this continuing idea of stigma in our society. And
right.
I'll often have medical students come into my office who are applying to residencies, and they'll really be wondering, should I talk about my own history of mental illness?
Really?
Or struggle as I go to apply to this next level phase, because it's something that's meaningful to me, informs my choice of career, but I worry that it will be stigmatized by people reviewing my application, and I oftentimes don't quite know how to answer that question.
Wow, Kaz, that really surprised me. I mean, they're applying for residencies in the Department of Psychiatry,
right,
and they're worried about talking about their own...
Yes, Department of Psychiatry's across the country, and they, or other disciplines like internal medicine or pediatrics, and they don't know how honest to be about their personal journey and struggle, even though it informs the richness of their life, because they worry that that will not reflect as highly on them.
Right. On Twitter, Maddie says, I struggled with severe depression last semester, and I struggled to find providers off campus who took my insurance. My university has an 8-session limit for counseling services on campus due to lack of resources. Greg, is that common, too? You cap out.
Yes, it is. I mean, many counseling centers have a session limit. I mean, we've chosen not to. We've chosen to really manage these on a case-by-case basis. But it's a finite resource, and so many of them do that. And, as this caller mentioned, there are issues around insurance and access. I mean, this is a huge national debate we've gone through for the last several years on access and how do you pay for care and some of those sort of things. And it's a real issue because care is oftentimes not available. If people don't have insurance or the providers in your area aren't on the insurance panel, it's very expensive. All of those things have a huge impact in accessing and in people's ability to access care.
Call here from Mahek in St. Paul. Hey, good morning, and thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm glad that your call is discussing stigma, because I'm a part of the South Asian community, and while I haven't personally experienced depression or youth counseling, I think when students are coming to college...
I really have to apologize. I cannot hear a word you're saying, because I think you're somewhere really noisy. Could I ask you to move to a place that's quiet or call us back? How about that? Let me go to Lindsay in Woodbury. Hey, Lindsay, hi.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share that currently I'm 35. I went to college some time ago. Mm-hmm. I was 17 when I was a freshman, and I didn't know what depression was. I didn't know what anxiety was. I know now that I have anxiety disorders, including social anxiety disorders. I have depression. I'm on my way to my therapist right now. But at the time, in 1999, I didn't know what it was. So I turned to drugs and alcohol. And, hey, social anxiety went away because I was drunk at parties every weekend. And one professor asked me if I wanted to be there. I said yes, he helped me out, but nobody else had any kind of advice or anything for me, and I didn't know to ask or to seek care. It just got worse. I managed to graduate in 4 years, believably, and I didn't get the mental health care that I needed until I got deeper into drugs. I had an early pregnancy. My life is fantastic now, thank God. But at the time, I really could have used some definition of this is what's happening to you.
Right. Wow. You've really come through it, Lindsay, and out on the other side. Really good to hear your story. I'm glad you shared it. You raise a couple of things that I wanted to go back to Kaz and Greg with. Greg, first, do college faculty and advisors and even some of these RAs know what to look for? And how important is that? We're hearing our caller say that it was a professor who spotted this.
Well, it's incredibly important, and really the last 15 to 20 years in college counseling centers and college health centers have worked specifically at helping faculty identify these things, because as providers, we're not out in the classroom. You know, here at Cornell, we developed a program called Notice and Respond, which talks to faculty about doing just that, noticing and responding. They don't have to be therapists, but just doing what this caller experienced of saying, wow, here's what's going on. Here's some ways it can help. You know, that kind of interaction can have a huge impact on people's life and their future direction. And that change has been something that organizations like the Jed Foundation and Active Minds and many kind of national organizations across the country have really focused on. How can we do what's called gatekeeper training? How can we educate faculty? How can we work on destigmatizing some of the things that Kaz was talking about? How can we really arm faculty with the skills to say, here's what's going on, here's how you can get help. And I'm not a therapist, but I want to support you, and here's some directions you can go in. So that's something that, you know, in the last 20 years in my work in college mental health, I've seen change across the country drastically to
that's
do
good.
Exactly what should have happened earlier with the caller.
That's really good to hear. Kaz, you know, the other thing that Lindsay brought up was the culture of drugs and alcohol, particularly probably alcohol, on college campuses, which, I mean, that's how she was self-medicating to deal with the anxiety and the depression. That may look like typical college behavior to some of these gatekeepers that Greg was talking about. So how do you inform faculty, RAs, who can be on the lookout for the kind of behavior where you're using drugs and alcohol to medicate?
Yes, I'm so relieved Lindsay brought up this idea of substance use in the college age, because we know it really increases the risk of bad outcome, including death or suicide, accidental or intentional, when drugs and alcohol are involved. So it really increases the risks. And I think it kind of gets back to what's the function of the alcohol and potential drug experimentation that people are doing in college. Is it something that's social, or is it something, like you said, where they're self-medicating, or it's something that they can do to tolerate distress that they might be experiencing? And that might be difficult for an RA to tease out or kind of understand, but it might be simple as asking a question of what does this alcohol do for you, and what do you need it for? And depending on the answer, that might help point in the direction.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about my experience in college quite a while ago, but remembering some of the people on my floor who were doing exactly what you've both described, and it just looked like hard partying, you know, freshman year, just learning how to deal with the presence of alcohol. Now, as I look back on that, I think I can remember the people that, Greg, were using it in a way that was dangerous, and it was masking some other mental health problems.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, alcohol, other drugs, really the main function that they serve is to help us not feel something we don't want to feel.
Yeah.
And all approaches to therapy and an effective way of dealing with those uncomfortable emotions is within kind of a exposure response prevention paradigm, which means you lean into the emotions, you find other ways of coping that don't involve drinking or don't involve these things that are more damaging. And some of it is kind of, unfortunately, many people think of the college experience as, well, part of what you do is you drink. I think we're trying to shift and change that, because, you know, these lines aren't that bright in terms of, is this just partying, or is this someone who's now developing a serious substance use problem? And as Kaz referenced, I mean, the number of suicides and alcohol-related deaths in higher education are high. I mean, those are the main causes of death among our population.
Oh, my gosh.
And alcohol plays a large role. And we know from data that the alcohol use in this age is pretty high. And figuring out ways to social norm, to highlight people who aren't drinking, to arm, kind of, again, RAs and faculty with data about, here's how you can respond to this. This isn't necessarily normal. Here are some more healthy ways of coping, is essential.
Greg Yeals with us from Cornell, Kaz Nelson with us from the University of Minnesota, as we talk about depression among students in college and hearing. I want to tell you, I really appreciate you calling in to tell me about your experiences with this in college, or to talk to me about it on Twitter. We've acknowledged there's still a stigma around this, but these are the kinds of discussions with help and resources blended into the conversation that I think are important. And as I suggested, you're informing the conversation here with your experience. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, where John says, I knew my school had a clinic, but I didn't know it had free counseling until my third semester. It helped a lot once I found out about it. And then Katie says, I was a 2017 grad. I was excited to see the conversation on mental health grow over my 4 years, but the capacity in counseling wasn't enough. Just getting in on this, I'm asking you, if you're a fairly recent college grad and you experienced depression in college, how did your school respond? Where did you get the help? And if you're a parent and you've dealt with this, has the school stepped up? How have you stepped in to help? What's been helpful for your son or daughter? And we'll be right back to your calls and your questions on the other side of news to John Wanamaker now. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. A shelter near Houston for at least 100 displaced people has been overrun by Harvey floodwaters. Jefferson County Sheriff's Deputy Marcus McClellan said today that the Bowers Civic Center in Port Arthur was inundated overnight due to overwhelming rainfall in a nearby overflowing canal. Authorities found a shivering toddler clinging to her drowned mother in a rain-swollen canal in southeast Texas after the woman tried to carry the child to safety from Harvey's floods. A spokesman for the fire rescue department in Beaumont said a witness saw the woman trying to carry her 18-month-old daughter to safety Tuesday afternoon when the current in a flooded drainage canal swept them away. A police and fire rescue team found the child alive, holding on to the woman. Officials in southwestern Louisiana are saying Tropical Storm Harvey appears to have produced little damage overnight. Calcasieu Parish Sheriff Tony Mancuso says that while he's still cautious, things are looking much better. As the main rains continue to stay west of Louisiana in Texas, Lake Charles recorded about an inch of rain overnight. Sheriff spokeswoman Kim Meyer says deputies rescued a few people on the parish's western edge where more rain fell. President Trump will kick off his lobbying effort for a tax overhaul at an event with a Midwestern manufacturing backdrop and some economic tough talk, but he is not expected to offer a detailed proposal. Instead, in Springfield, Missouri, today, Trump will give remarks that the White House says will focus on his vision for spurring job creation and economic growth by cutting taxes and revising the tax code. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites. I'm Tom Cran. What's news and what's for dinner? Join me starting at 3.
If you've just happened onto this conversation about college students and depression, you can find the whole show in the podcast later today. In fact, lots of you listening to podcasts about the books you were raised with. Wow, I could barely keep up with the tweets and the calls on that one. That's on the podcast. Refuge, one of the novels that I've been recommending all summer. I love it. You can find that on the podcast. How to do it? Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Minnesota Iron. Ferris wheels, gondolas, tractors, and other State Fair staples are made of steel from Minnesota Iron. You can celebrate all things Minnesota at the State Fair and all things Minnesota Iron at minnesotairon.org/mnmine.
Back to the conversation now. Kaz Nelson with us from the U of M and Greg Eels with us from Cornell and to Mackenzie in St. Paul. Mackenzie, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for taking my call, Carrie. I'm really glad that you guys are talking about this. I actually am still in the process of graduating from school. All my classes are done, but I'm still waiting on that diploma, and it actually took me 5.5 years to graduate because of my experience with depression.
What happened?
It hit me sophomore year, and I didn't want to acknowledge what it was. I didn't really have a word for it. I started telling myself I was just being lazy. Because of sort of, and Greg was talking about this earlier, the sort of national culture around depression, it wasn't something I wanted to give any credence to, and it ended up hitting me really hard during a study abroad experience. And when I came back, I ended up taking a semester-long leave of absence because I couldn't continue to do what I was doing. And to Cass's point about alcohol use, that also started to increase in my life, and I didn't realize why. And so both of those things, that the alcohol use and sort of the national culture on depression, really had an impact on me. Fortunately, I've been able to, I've started therapy and antidepressants now, but I really wish that had been a conversation that was much larger when I started school, so that I would have had a word for what was happening to me when it started to occur.
Do you mean, Mackenzie, that, they would talk about it maybe during orientation, or professors might? How would that have been woven into the experience, do you think?
Right. Well, I mean, when we start, obviously, you're given certain student resources. You do hear about student health, but nobody really focuses in on depression as something that occurs to students. And I know from having spent plenty of time with other students that depression was a major issue, not just for me, but for a lot of other students, and it was hitting them for the very first time in those first few years of college. So if we could have known about that way earlier, like sort of at the beginning, so we had a name for what might be happening and a resource we could go to. Fortunately, I was very lucky to have an advisor who sort of saw what was happening and really took time to understand me and my situation. So academically, I didn't suffer too much, though my grades ended up not where I wanted them to be because of that whole situation.
Well, you have the diploma, and congratulations on that, and I wish you well out in the world with that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Kaz, how about, I'm hearing
our callers say, you know, we wanted more reminders. A lot of students weren't sure where to turn, what to do, because they were experiencing it for the first time. How can schools respond?
Yes, and it occurred to me that there is also a subset of students who maybe went to the orientation and received that information but have unrealistic self standards or high perfectionism traits and think, oh, but that won't be me, or, oh, I'd rather die than, you know, admit that I'm one of the people who struggle or that need assistance and help. And that's a dangerous, potentially fatal attitude. And so schools have a responsibility to both share information but then not leave it there, walk with students along the way to help educate about what they might be experiencing, and let people know that sometimes taking a semester off of school, in Mackenzie's case, is a better outcome and a healthier outcome than being dead, and it doesn't mean that you're a failure.
You know, Greg, I was also thinking about what Mackenzie said about the other students in his circle. Do you also alert or train other students to be on the lookout on this?
We do. We actually have a program called Friend to Friend that's a video that you can watch and talk for students, and then talks to them about how you can talk to a colleague who's struggling with depression. So, yes, we do have a program with that, because I think that's more effective than, you know, some of the orientation materials, because, you know, every student in orientation, it's kind of like what Kaz said, they don't think it's going to be them, or they have internalized perfection standards. Or, you know, I've been to a lot of orientation meetings and I've just tuned everything out. And it is kind of, with counseling service, it's one of those things where you don't think about it until you need it. So having training people around the person to say, hey, kind of like Mackenzie said, you know, someone intervened and said, you know, hey, here's how you can get help. Hey, this is really important. And that's what's really powerful. So I think our efforts have really focused on how do you train students through our friend-to-friend program, or faculty and staff through our notice and respond program, because those networks are what's essential in connecting people to the needed resources.
Dalton called in from St. Paul. He said, I went to the U of M. I had anxiety. I ended up dropping out. It's important for people to talk about it. Later, I found out that many members of my family were on anxiety medication. I wish we'd all talked about it earlier so we could have dealt with it. Greg, I wanted to ask you, I was reading up on this UCLA Depression Grand Challenge this research project they're undertaking. I think it's over the course of 35 years. What is it that people like you and Kaz and other specialists don't still understand about depression, and maybe younger people, that this grand challenge may answer?
Well, it's hard. I think there's a lot that's understood about depression. There are effective treatments, as, you know, as many of our callers have said. When they got help, their lives got better, and many of them have turned things around. You know, I think some of the bigger challenges are really on the front end, and how this can be helpful is, how do you identify it sooner? How do you get to that treatment before you have to go through taking a year off, or before you have bouts with alcohol and other drugs and self-medicate for a decade and lose a chunk of your life? And, you know, I think the challenge is, how do you identify these things earlier? How do you change some of the broader cultural issues? How do you get families to talk about it? Because, yeah, we've seen that. It's a very common phenomenon where people in their own families don't even talk to each other about their own experiences and what they learned and what medications they've taken that have worked, or how therapy's been helpful. So I think anything, and even why this conversation's important, anything that kind of normalizes the symptoms that Kaz went over, that if you're experiencing that, here's how to get help, and normalizes that help seeking. That, to me, is what's most important, and how any broad effort is important.
Kaz, I know that that you're steeped in this as well. I mean, what are some of the questions that remain for you around depression that this grand challenge may answer?
Well, I think we're still early in being very precise about our diagnosis and treatment and different options for intervention. So somebody might come in the front door of a clinic and say, well, I'm distressed and I'm using alcohol and I feel overwhelmed. That could be a whole number of illnesses. Or it could be, somebody who's otherwise healthy but having mild symptoms. And so whether this is early development of a bipolar disorder or depression or something like a borderline personality disorder, we're not always good about sorting that out on the front end. And sometimes people end up in treatment pathways that don't actually fit the issue, which can further compound problems. And so I'm really interested in early precision so that the correct treatment pathway is accessed.
Kaz, I know you have a lot of experience with adult depression as well. Do you find that if a depression episode emerges, you know, at 18, 19 years old, perhaps in college, then this is something that people will deal with, you know, for their lives, that they really have to be on the alert. Or sometimes is this just episodic and you never have to worry about it again?
For certain percentage of people, it will be episodic and might even represent a difficulty adjusting to college. We would call that an adjustment disorder, and that looks very similar to a temporary period of depression. But once you start stacking up 1, 2, 3, or 4 episodes of depression or difficulty with adjustment, then the likelihood of experiencing a future episode becomes very high. And so we need to make sure that there's a long-term management plan in those cases.
Kaz, I really appreciate the time today. Thank you so much. I know you have to run off.
Oh, it's been absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for bringing attention on this important issue.
For us, too. Greg, what would you say about that transition from student to adult and being watchful about this?
Well, I think it's incredibly important, and Kaz is exactly right. I mean, depression is a broad category that is comorbid with many other presenting concerns, like anxiety or personality disorders or bipolar disorders. It depends on kind of when you see them. And I think college is oftentimes the first place where you're beginning to see these things. And people, as many of our callers have said, people don't necessarily have the language for it.
Right.
Treatment providers, it's not always easy to figure out. It's not always easy to diagnose. Matching it to the right treatment. People don't respond to the same medications. So they don't respond to the same, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance commitment therapy or DBT or different therapy approaches. You know, people respond to them differently. So you've got to modulate the therapy. So it's not ever going to be a cookie cutter response. And yet the grand challenge and some of these other things are essential to think big and think about how we can change the culture, how we can change how we do treatment and diagnosis, and how we can change the whole conversation about it and begin to reduce some of the stigma, because that often is one of the things that gets in people's way, like many of the students have talked about today.
They have. Jesse called from Worthington, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to your call, but he says, and this is important, my son went through this. This isn't always due to changes. It's also hard to observe changes in behavior when you're far away as the parent.
Yes.
I had to clue into little statements like, I'm having a rough time. It sounds like not a big deal. Looking back, I see it was a big deal. Okay, for parents to be listening for this, what should they hear, Greg?
Well, I mean, all of those kind of things. I think it's, you know, as a parent with, you know, again, I have two a son and a daughter, two students right now who are college students.
Right.
You're always kind of balancing. You don't want to be too intrusive. Some of this is about them figuring out what they can do, who they are, their identity, their friendships. And if you're involved in that too much, you're going to get in the way of that. On the other side, you want to be a support for them. So, you know, any kind of conversation, checking in about relationships, about mood, you know, any conversations about, you know, as Cass said earlier, about wanting to hurt yourself, definitely take very seriously. But I think, you know, mainly following their lead of kind of asking, cluing into certain things if things aren't going well, being a support, being open, being aware of resources, you know, thinking about, have you talked to the counseling service, making those kind of suggestions, really relying on your relationship that's evolving into an adult-adult relationship with your son or daughter when they're in college, is very important that those social supports cannot be underestimated.
Call here from, I think, right about this, Greg, from Mary in Minneapolis. Hi, Mary. Your daughter is going through this now. Is that right?
Yeah. My daughter is, she's about to start her third year of college, and she was diagnosed before she left for school. She knew since she was about 16 that she was suffering depression and anxiety disorder. It was pretty bad, and so when she left, you know, you try to kind of get your ducks in a row, and so she knows where to go and, you know, who to talk to, but, you know, it was really a transition for her to be advocating for herself for the first time, making those appointments. And, you know, it was hard for her to get in during the hours that they were open. Mm-hmm. And they have a therapist and they have a psychiatrist, but they have one psychiatrist. And then that psychiatrist would leave. And so then it would be another, you know, waiting until you get in with the new person. And she had a really hard time. It's been a real struggle.
Well,
I think she's doing better now.
Let me bring Greg in to say, so for Mary's position here, Greg, what would you advise?
Well, I mean, so one of the broader issues we haven't talked about is, I think nationally, our mental health care system struggles. So many of the things college students confront are actually somewhat better than you and I would confront with our insurance, or we'd have to find a provider. You know, when you're depressed, to do all these things you have to do to get care is really difficult. And it's actually, even though it's not always easy for college students, at least there's a single place you can go to that can either refer you or meet with you, versus if you or I want care, even with good insurance, we've got to call, we've got to take steps, we've got to do X, Y, or Z, we've got to find somebody to prescribe for us. We have to do all of the legwork. So, I mean, some of it is about a national conversation, including higher education, of how you make mental health care accessible. How do you make it easier for people to get the care that they need? How do you give them those kind of tools? And yeah, everything the caller described, there's things that happen at higher education mental health because people get better offers and they leave. And colleges don't oftentimes staff their counseling centers up to national standards of what would be seen as a bare minimum because of other costs, and they want to keep tuition and fees down and some of those other things. So, yeah, there's a real push and pull around that, and unfortunately that is oftentimes students' experience, and one of their main complaints is I couldn't get in fast enough and I couldn't get the level of treatment that I needed. And I think every counseling center is struggling with, well, how do we do that?
Right.
How do we advocate for more funding? How do we provide a better service? And in some ways counseling centers do it better than nationally. I mean, I was at a conference where Richard Carmona, who was the Surgeon General at the time, said college health is an example for the rest of the country.
Really? Like,
wow. Yeah, because there's a single place you can go to, which is not the case for any of us, that our system is a patchwork of underfunded county clinics, private practitioners, county hospitals, state hospitals that are closing, that having ongoing treatment is not something that's often available anywhere off of a college campus. And I think college counseling centers are trying to fill that gap, but many times people's experience still are not adequate.
Mary, are you still there?
Yeah.
So your daughter is, what, arriving at school right about now then for her third year?
Yep. She's actually home. She stayed there over the summer. She has some credits to make up, and she's going back tomorrow. You know, she went through a lot of the times. It was really hard. I mean, I have to say, just like he was saying, that just trying to navigate the mental health system as a parent for my daughter was really hard. And then when she turned 18, it was like she's no longer an adolescent. And even within the context of the system, it's like one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. And they'll say, oh, well, just go in and get a med check. And you can't get in for a med check because you can't go back to your doctor anymore. You have to find a new one. And so it was good when she went to school and they had it all there. But then on the other hand, like, for instance, she had one of her professors had you couldn't have any absences. She had a policy against unexcused absences, and my daughter went over it. And even though she had therapists, people were advocating for her, she said, I'm sorry, she's going to fail.
You've just brought up something that I wanted to bring back to Greg, and we talked about this a little bit, but specifically, Greg, if not only an absence, but, you know, away from school, but you're missing some classes. I mean, how do you talk to faculty members that you're just getting to know about something so sensitive? What's your advice on that?
Well, I think if you know you have the diagnosis, as Cass said, going to the disability office is key because they can help. They can oftentimes get accommodations for some of these things. Now, attendance is oftentimes not one of them. So that's where, you know, as counseling centers, we do a lot of that work of advocating with faculty. And that being said, faculty at every university can do what they want with their class. And it's very difficult sometimes for students. And sometimes faculty aren't willing to kind of meet students halfway or even listen to a counseling center folks. But many times they are willing to work with you. But I think, yeah, some of it puts a lot of burden on the student to step in and say, well, here's what's going on with me. Here's what I need. You know, my counselor's doing this. My person that I've met with at Disability Services is doing this. I mean, when you're depressed and struggling with these things, there's a lot that's still put on you.
Right. Right. So are you saying if you're unable to, you know, get a therapist to go to the individual professor, you're saying you have to have these conversations?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's much like you and I would have to have these conversations if we were, you know, struggling with depression and talking to our boss or our supervisor.
Right. But we're adults.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this is one of the things as a parent that's so hard, too, because once your son or daughter is 18, they are, too. The law treats them just like they would treat me and you.
Just as Mary said.
Yeah. And it's very difficult as a parent because the minute before they're 18, you know, you have access to their records. You know, you play a role with their healthcare providers. The minute they turn 18, you can't get that access unless your son or daughter signs a release, you know, under HIPAA and state privacy laws. So it's an immediate transition, which oftentimes feels artificial, but that's what the law says.
We have a call that I think pertains to that, to Susie in Southwest Minnesota. Susie, it sounds like you ran into that, some of the privacy issues around your daughter's depression.
Yes. I am one that definitely has a problem with the FERPA law. I think that needs to be addressed again because we have a daughter that was depressed. This was her sophomore year. It probably started the end of her freshman year, but she transferred colleges and went up there, and she was partying every weekend. That's how she was self-medicating herself. She would go to the student health services and get some issues. She eventually did get herself on some medication there too, but they won't tell you anything. If you call up there, they still won't tell you anything because it's all of that FERPA. And ended up that our daughter, once she got home that summer, she ended up inpatient in hospitalization. And let's just say we are very thankful we have her, because from what all happened, she could have easily been gone. But nobody watched out for her.
Greg, what do you do about this? I understand the privacy laws here, but Susie makes a great point, too. As parents, you want to know if it's gotten this serious.
Yeah, so just to clarify, I mean, there are privacy laws. FERPAs have to do with educational records. Treatment records are often covered by HIPAA, or they're covered under New York state law, that they're actually exemptions under FERPA. So, you know, the laws that often govern privacy around healthcare are the same laws that govern everybody in terms of state privacy laws and federal laws. So just to be clear with that, you know, one of the challenges is the privacy laws exist for a reason, and every good provider would work with their client to engage family in ways that are helpful. But the law is very clear and shouldn't change in the sense that the autonomy to decide who gets that information is with the individual client. Because not everybody's family is supportive. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those unsupportive families want that privacy information. And if we shared it, you know, no one would come see us for care. Right. That being said, I mean, if someone is at imminent risk to themselves, you can involve providers, you can involve other people. So it's always a delicate dance, I think. You know, every therapist would work with someone to involve family or key supports in their life. But the law is pretty clear, and it's there for a reason. And it actually saves people's lives because it gets them into treatment. And that's the thing that saves their lives, according to all the research that's out there, is once they get into treatment, the risk of suicide and other things goes down. And generally, treatment works, so not for everybody.
You know, it struck me that you've said a couple times that you have kids who are both in college now.
Yeah.
Really testing your life as a counselor and your life as a parent. Yes. Right?
Yeah, it is. And I empathize with every parent because it is very hard to let go. I mean, you've invested so much, your time, your money, your heart, your soul into your son or daughter doing well. You want to be able to be there for them. And, you know, people struggle. And there are people all the time who are in the painful situation of watching their son or daughter struggle with a mental illness, being limited in what they can do, spending their life savings. I mean, these are our people's experiences. And, you know, changing privacy is not going to fix that. You know, I think there are other kind of ways that we have to do a better job around treatment, around access, around destigmatization that I think are most important. But, yeah, it is not easy. This is a very difficult transition time for students and for parents. Everything's changing with your family dynamic and what's important to you. And navigating them becoming adults is very challenging. And they need our help, too. They can't just do it alone.
Boy, Greg, you were just terrific. I'm so glad you had the time to do this. So informative.
Thank you.
Greg Eales with us, Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Cornell. Now, I know a lot more of you wanted to get in on the conversation. I couldn't get to all your tweets, and I certainly couldn't get to all your calls. We'll come back to the topic. I see there's more to talk about here from you at another day. But if you have missed a chunk of the conversation, I want to let you know, Greg and Kaz Nelson from the U of M had some excellent advice, and you can find that, the whole show, online or on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller to find it.